Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Aurora Borealis, more commonly known as the Northern Lights, have inspired legends, songs, and stories for generations. Recent atmospheric conditions have made the aurora especially active and have delighted Alaskans, as well as people in the lower 48 who don't have the joy of seeing them as often as we do. What's the science behind this spike in activity? Why do the colorful displays happen at all? And how can you capture better photos of them? Understanding the science and enjoying the mystique of the vibrant streaks of light in the winter sky is our discussion today on Talk of Alaska.
Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, from Alaska Public Media, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Do you remember the first time you saw the Northern Lights or heard a story about them? Have you seen the recent displays? Alaskans shared beautiful shots of multicolored aurora shows all over Alaska, and some of my family members shared photos from Eden Prairie, Minnesota, of the aurora they saw in the Midwest. You can see some of those photos on our Talk of Alaska post at alaskapublic.org. Our guests today spend a lot of time studying and photographing the aurora, and they're here with us to talk about the science and the majesty of these lights in the winter night sky. Vincent Ledvina is a space physics PhD student at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and is also known as the Aurora Guy. Vincent runs an aurora tour company in Fairbanks and has seen aurora in a lot of different places. We'll hear more about that in just a bit. Also with us today is Don Hampton. Don is a research associate professor at UAF and the Geophysical Institute. And on the line from Kodiak is Brian Venwa. Brian is a reporter at KMXT in Kodiak and is an award-winning photographer with his own photography business there on the island. Welcome, all of you.
Good morning.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for being on hand. Thank you. You can also join us, Alaskans. Do you have some great Northern Light sighting stories? Are you aware of legends about the aurora and want to share them? Or do you have science-related questions about it? You can call us statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email your questions or comments, talk@alaskapublic.org. So, Don, start us off with some of the basics. What are people seeing when they observe Aurora Borealis or the Northern Lights? What is happening that lights up the atmosphere this way?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely very popular, and we all love to watch it. But it ultimately starts with the sun. Just like our terrestrial weather, the activity of the aurora starts with the sun. The sun's very hot. There's always a stream of charged particles coming off the surface of the sun, sort of like, you know, steam off the top of a cup of coffee. They're coming out pretty fast. They're moving like 250 miles per second. And they're charged particles, so they induce a lot of currents associated with them as well. When those bump into our Earth's magnetic field, it does several things. They interact with that magnetic field. Those particles can get trapped in our magnetic field and then processes back there accelerate those electrons primarily. And when they come down, they're bumping into our atmospheric constituents up in the upper atmosphere and producing light. The energy is transferred from the electrons to those atoms and molecules. They get excited, and then when they relax that excitation, they produce the light that we see the aurora. So it's very similar to a neon sign, where you basically run a current through a gas in a sort of evacuated tube, and you get these lights, and that's the lights we're seeing with the aurora.
The neon sign in the sky. What creates the different colors of the aurora? Is it chemical reactions?
It's just the nature of those atoms and molecules. They all have those electrons orbiting around the outside, and those are in very precise energies they have in those orbits. And so when they move from one orbit to the other, that's when they emit the light. Those are very well defined. And so the green that we see, that's the most common color, and some of that red on the very top, those are oxygen atoms that are producing those. And then when you get the really exciting aurora and you see those sort of pinkish red lower borders, those are nitrogen molecules being produced. But it's just simple excitation and relaxation that produces those colors.
The reds of the aurora were especially visible in the recent displays. Ned Rozell, the science writer at UAF, wrote about that. Why was that? It sounds like that's somewhat unusual.
It is somewhat unusual. So what we had is a very large storm. Like I said, there's always the solar wind coming off of the sun. But when we're going through a period called solar maximum, which we're doing right now, sometimes that solar wind sort of gets trapped in these regions that we call sunspots. People have probably heard about those. And then they build up a lot of pressure and a lot of density, and then they're released sort of dramatically and come in these big waves of these particles. So the density goes up very high, the speed goes up very high. And when that happens, that really squeezes our magnetosphere, the magnetic field around the Earth. And that loosens a whole bunch more particles than we normally see. And so what we do get these very big storms is the auroral zone, where we normally see it in Alaska, now spreads down into the lower 48. And they're just scads of particles coming down. So everything's just a lot brighter, especially these low energy particles coming down, and they produce that red light that we see. So it's a pretty uncommon sight. Yeah, once every solar cycle, we tend to see one or two of these big red events. So that was quite exciting. I was actually on my way home driving to the north. I didn't see anything. And then I turned around the corner and started looking west, and I saw the beautiful glow through the trees. I said, okay, that's a very bright red aurora.
Mm. And you talked a little about this, but kind of flesh out more about why there has been so much and such widespread activity in recent weeks. What's going on?
Yeah, so this whole last couple of years, we've been going through what's called solar max. And we define that solar max by the number of sunspots. And what's happening is the sun has a magnetic field as well, but it actually reverses every 11 years. And it doesn't just flip over, it actually sort of collapses and then shrinks in the other direction. And when it's doing that collapsing, that magnetic field, it doesn't look like that nice sort of, you know, apple core shape that we often see with magnetic fields. And when we sprinkle the iron filings on the magnetic bar, it goes very, 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 very complicated. And that's where these sunspots begin to develop. And that can trap some of the solar wind and produce these large storms that happen that we go along. So these are called coronal mass ejections. They're associated with solar flares. And they happen sort of randomly. And they can happen in any place on the sun. They're not always directed at Earth. But when they happen to be coming toward the Earth, that's when we pick up these big storms. And like I said, that really compresses our magnetic field. And a lot of energy gets transferred into there, and that's what drives the aurora.
All right, Don, thanks so much for getting us started. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and today we're talking about the science and the mystique of the aurora borealis. On the line from Fairbanks is Don Hampton. Don is a research associate professor at UAF and the Geophysical Institute. Vincent Ledvina is also in Fairbanks, and Vincent is a space physics PhD student at UAF and owner of an Aurora tour company in Fairbanks. And Brian Venwa is on the line from Kodiak. Brian is a reporter and an award-winning photographer. You can join our conversation if you have questions or comments, want to talk about your own experience viewing the Northern Lights. Statewide, that number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So Vincent, I want to turn to you now for a moment. What is a professional aurora chaser? It sounds safer than a storm chaser, but I don't know what it is.
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for having me on the show. Really appreciate it. Happy to be here. Professional aurora chaser. I feel like I've just seen the aurora so many times that I'm calling myself that now. I think I've seen the aurora maybe 200 or 300 times in my life, and most of those times up here in Alaska. But I'm from the Midwest, so I've seen the aurora plenty of times from North Dakota, which is where I got my bachelor's degree. But yeah, I guess I've just seen the aurora so many times up here in Alaska. It's just a privilege to live somewhere where it's common, and you know, it never gets old for me.
You've, as you noted, you've observed aurora activity in many places, not just Fairbanks. Tell us about where else you've been beyond the Midwest and how the activity compares or contrasts with Alaska's skies.
Yeah, so first of all, I'll talk about the comparison between maybe like the lower 48 and Alaska. A lot of people say that once you've seen the aurora once, you know, you've checked it off the bucket list. But I would say that, first of all, every single night is different. When you go out there, of course, there are patterns that, you know, we can pick up on, and science will tell us that the aurora will do certain things at certain times. But every single night, the aurora ends up doing something that's a little bit surprising. So for me, it's always a fun game to go out and just see what nature has in store. And from the perspective of mid-latitudes, like in the Midwest, down to the lower 48, the aurora is usually off to the horizon, so sort of just bubbling along to the north. And only during the really big events, like what we had last week, where you know, we have a huge coronal mass ejection coming in, you know, severe geomagnetic storm, we reached G4, so that's KP8 out of 9. So that's almost the max that you can get. And in those cases, the aurora will come overhead for those mid-latitudes, but usually it's just sort of a, you know, very bright red glow with maybe some pillars. It still looks different than what we have up here in Alaska, which is typically these green, really nice, sharply defined arcs and pillars and things like that. So, you know, for people thinking, okay, I've already seen the aurora down, let's say, in Minnesota, I don't need to come up to Alaska, I think it's still worth planning a trip just so you can see what it's like up here. But besides the Midwest and Alaska, I've seen the aurora in Churchill, Manitoba, which is one of my favorite spots. That's right on the southern shores of the Hudson Bay. I spent 2 weeks there in March of 2022, and then another 3 weeks in the fall of that same year. And then through University of Alaska Fairbanks, participating in some field campaigns for sounding rockets, I've seen the aurora in some villages up north, like Fort Yukon and Vinatai, Alaska. I've seen the aurora in Iceland a few times. And then probably the most strange location for my aurora chasing adventures was actually in India last year. I was actually just there on vacation, and we ended up having one of these big geomagnetic storms like we had last week, but this one reached a KP9 out of 9, so that's the maximum strength. And I couldn't see it very well with my eye, but I was in the northern part of the country, and I saw the data and the solar wind spiking, and I went outside and brought my camera with me, and there was a faint red glow on the horizon, just on the, you know, sort of cresting over these big mountain peaks of the Himalayas. So that was really, really unique. And, you know, my goal is to see the aurora on all 7 continents before I die. So I've checked off Asia. Now I just have to get all the other continents.
That's fantastic. Before we get Brian in here, Vincent, I wanted to ask you about, you have a really early memory of aurora. Tell us about your first sighting.
Yeah, so back in 2003, that was on the descending phase of solar cycle 23. So we're in solar cycle 25 right now. And maybe we can talk about this later, but there's this interesting statistical relationship that says that on the downswing of these solar cycles, and we're currently on the downswing more or less of solar cycle 25, you often see pretty extreme space weather events. So back in 2003, we had a big storm called the Halloween storm that happened, of course, you know, on Halloween of 2003. And I was in Minnesota. I grew up in the Twin Cities, and I actually remember seeing the aurora overhead and all around me. And that's probably one of my earliest memories of my childhood, and definitely my earliest aurora chase, if you can call it that. And yeah, it was just a really cool experience. I remember just looking out. My parents' house had these windows that sort of overlooked, you know, like the Mississippi River Valley. And I just remember seeing what looked like spotlights just dancing all over the sky. And that's what my parents said that they were. I don't think they realized what was going on. But then, you know, later in life, when I became interested in the science, I still had that memory with me. So I went back and I checked the archives. And sure enough, there was a G4, you know, KP8 out of 8 out of 9 geomagnetic storm that night. So that was a, you know, really big event. And I actually remember seeing that.
What a great story. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Brian, I want to move to you now. You said in an earlier interview that a few times a year you get a notification on your phone about aurora activity. Please tell us about that app and how others of us can get it.
Yeah. So for the last few years, honestly, I was just following another photographer, and he was talking about getting this Aurora app. It's kind of purple and has a little bit of teal on it, and I just found it on the App Store. I was like, oh, okay, we'll give it a shot. And it was kind of funny that I was like, okay, whatever, it's fine. And then it's always funny that it comes off as a critical alert, as if there's like some kind of like a tsunami or something on its way. Then I'm like, oh, okay, so even if it's 2 a.m. and my phone's on Do Not Disturb, it'll still go off, and then I have to decide when I'm laying in bed, and it's like, is it worth it? Am I too tired? And most of the time it ends up being worth it. But there's also like going through UAF using their Aurora forecast. I check that somewhat regularly, about once a week, just to see if there's anything coming up so I can maybe get some sleep before and know when a notification might pop up.
Thank you, Brian, for letting us know. And I know that folks are looking for that app right now. I see them looking through the control room window. So I think we've got some excited production staff here. And, you know, lots of people think they're photographers now because they have a phone that takes pictures. But that's really different from pro gear. So, Brian, what do you use for capturing the Aurora?
So right now I'm using a Fujifilm X-T4. It's not the greatest camera on the market, but it meets like 90% of my needs, so it works out just fine.
And you said film? It's a film camera?
No, so the brand is Fujifilm, but it is
it's
a mirrorless professional camera. Yeah, I just like it because it's a little bit lighter, because realistically the best camera that you can have is the one that you're going to bring with you. And if you think you need something super high-end, then yeah, get like something that costs way more than what I have. But also I know that if a camera gets too heavy, I'm probably not going to bring it. So that's kind of why I use the gear that I have. And I think having something like that, the bigger the sensor you have, the better. My Fujifilm camera has an APS-C size sensor, so it's kind of on the mid-range, a little bit smaller than a full-frame camera, which a lot of people might be familiar with, like film. So it would be, the sensor's a little bit smaller, but still takes way better photos than what most phones are capable of. And yeah, using super bright lenses that have a wide aperture, which means that it lets more light in. It's usually calculated in f-stops, which is... the brightest one that I have goes to F2, which is pretty fine, but most lenses will start at F4, which is okay, not ideal, but we'll get the job done for most cases.
And are you using a super fast or super slow shutter speed?
I'm using a really slow shutter speed. So usually, if you think about taking a photo with your phone or something, it's usually at about 1/60th of a second or faster. Which is pretty quick, you know, about a blink of an eye, and that's how long it takes to do things. But when it comes to things like night photography, shooting in the dark, and Vincent can probably talk about this too, is that you usually want to have a slower shutter speed, so I usually bring a tripod with me, so that, because my hand shakes, most people can't hold their hands perfectly still for, you know, 10 to 15 seconds, which is usually about where I start when I get my notifications on my phone and I decide to go out. At around a 10 to 15 second exposure, I'll turn my sensor up to about 1,600 for the sensitivity or the light boosting capabilities on my camera, and then using the brightest apertures that I have, whether that's F2 or F2.8 or F4, that's kind of been where I've been most lucky.
So I have a question by email that I was going to get to later, but it's here by email, so let's get to it now. And this is both for Brian and Vincent. Kodiak Fisher writes, hello, I've noticed a number of Aurora photos, especially from the lower 48, that look better than what I'm actually seeing in the Copper Valley in Alaska. Since I upgraded my phone a couple of years ago, I notice that the photos I take are actually more intense than what my eyes are seeing. I imagine this is because the lenses and low light capabilities have improved. Is this why in the past photographers with superior lenses were able to capture these incredible images all of the time? Or are they always in the right place and capturing light shows that most of us don't observe? Thanks for your insights. And it's signed Pat. So, Vincent and Brian, what are your thoughts about what's happening there with camera phones?
Yeah, the thing about your phones is that your phone can see infrared light, which is just a different type of radiation, and I'm sure Vincent can talk more about this. But yeah, it's basically there's light that our eyes can't see that the sun produces, but your phone's capable of seeing and will render it as a form of color. So that's often why, like Vincent mentioned earlier, that like he didn't see the red beams in India. But that's at least my understanding of what's going on and why sometimes taking a photo is going to be a little bit better than what you see with your eyes, or at least a little bit stronger
Vincent?
Than what you would see with your eyes.
Yeah, thank you, Brian. Vincent, your thoughts?
Yeah, I would agree with that, and also just add that, you know, people cannot see as well in the dark as cameras can because we have cells in the back of our eyes instead of pixels, which are found on camera sensors. So also the fact that everybody sees colors differently. I know on Aurora tours and workshops, you know, I might be standing next to a group of people and all of us are seeing different colors in the aurora. Some of us are seeing the greens, some of us are not seeing the greens, some of us are seeing reds, others are not seeing the reds, and everybody has different sensitivities to different colors. And what's great about cameras is you can pick out those really faint colors that are there in the aurora. I think that's a common misconception, is that, you know, it's just Photoshop or like the phone is doing something magical to pull out those colors. But really, those colors are there. We can actually, you know, measure them with scientific instruments and things. Those colors are there. It's just our eyes, they didn't evolve to go aurora chasing, unfortunately. So, you know, in the dark, we kind of revert back to black and white vision. But what's interesting is that when the aurora is super bright, you can start to pick out those colors.
All right. Thank you for that. Some camera advice there for folks that want to get good shots of the aurora. Don, going back to you, you conduct optical studies of upper atmospheric phenomenon. Are there other phenomena that you observe and study beyond the aurora, or is that the main focus?
Yeah, I mean, the main one here in Alaska, obviously, is the aurora. This is the unique place in the United States to be able to see the aurora. It's basically every night. I think any night it's dark and clear in Fairbanks, if you at least get up high enough and look north, you can probably see some sort of aurora. But there are other phenomena going on as well. There's a layer in the atmosphere called the airglow layer. That is a chemical reaction that happens all the time, and it's much, much dimmer. But there's camera systems all over the United States that are chasing that down, because that can also give us dynamics of what's happening at altitudes above 100 kilometers or so as well. I was actually involved in some of the early work on this upper atmospheric lightning called Sprites, because we had the low light level cameras due to the aurora. We were able to do this kind of work as well. So there are lots of fun things that happen in the atmosphere. Vincent can probably talk more about it, but there's actually sort of a citizen science thing that's happened recently, that there's a phenomena that's associated with aurora. We're still debating in the scientific circles whether we should call it aurora, but it's called Steve. Typically happens on the equatorward side of where the aurora is happening. And people have maybe seen it before, but with this explosion in the cameras that we were just talking about, the photographers taking pictures of the aurora would see the beautiful aurora and they'd say, well, what's this funny little purple stripe over here? And it turned out to be this phenomena that seems to be more of a glow, basically just the atmosphere being very warm and giving this broad band glow instead of these specific colors. So lots of things, you know, the better the technology gets, the more things we see in the atmosphere. It's always a lot of fun.
And Don, what does your research reveal about how often the aurora happens and what's going on in the upper atmosphere? How does it affect it?
Yeah, the way I like to put it is I'm old enough that I remember when we were still trying to figure out what the aurora, you know, what caused the aurora, when it happened, that sort of thing. And I like to liken it to that's what we were doing back in between the 50s and the mid-80s. Now what we're trying to, we understand sort of the basics of when and how the aurora is going to happen. Now what we're trying to understand is how that affects our upper atmosphere. Vincent mentioned earlier the phrase space weather. That wasn't a thing when I was in grad school, but now it's a very major thing, because we all rely on a lot of technology now, including satellites, power grids, and communications with satellites. And aurora and phenomena like the aurora can affect all of those things. So our focus on research now is to see how these large energy inputs, especially these big storms, they heat up the atmosphere, so the atmosphere expands. So low orbiting satellites like Starlink or other systems those satellite orbits are affected. And so you've got to worry about whether that's going to affect two satellites that might collide later on. That would be a very bad thing. We also worry about the communication between this layer in the upper atmosphere called the ionosphere. That affects radio communications, and it even affects GPS transmission. And then these big currents up in the ionosphere are creating these large magnetic fluctuations. And just like your alternator in your car, a large magnetic fluctuation can induce a voltage in a long linear metal structure like a power line. And so there are times when we get these large surges of power in power lines that are not really designed to be accepted. Back in 1989, there was one system in Quebec where one of the transformers basically went out, and that did a cascade, and the whole power system went out for several hours. So there are utilities and satellite providers who are very interested in what's going on, and our research in Alaska is to try to quantify how much these storms like this are going to affect the parameters they need to understand to do their operations.
And the aurora, at least in the past, in a previous interview, you talked about how it affected infrastructure. Tell us about the Carrington event in the 1800s.
Right. So probably the largest, at least in semi-modern history, 1859, there was a very large solar storm. Back there, we didn't have transcontinental power lines. We didn't have satellites, obviously. But one thing we did have is we did have transcontinental telegraph lines. And the supposition was, well, I mean, several of the telegraph operators were shocked. There were fires started, that sort of thing, in those lines. Supposition is if we had a storm like that now, that really would affect give same sort of effect in the power lines. And it may be that our infrastructure wouldn't be able to handle that. So that's our concern now, is are we going to have one of these Carrington events in the next 50 years or so? And are we in place to do, do we have the things in place to deal with that? Like I said, I think most power companies and utility providers are aware of these things and can take steps to help ameliorate that. So,
well, we apparently Alaskans are shy today. We're not getting calls yet, but we do have a number of emails that have come in. One of them is from Themer, writes, "Greetings to all. Will we soon see geomagnetic storms hitting Earth?"
Well, that's what just happened last week, was the November 11th and 12th, or 12th and 13th. That's what we call a geomagnetic storm. These CMEs basically perturb our magnetic field, the magnetosphere, and that's what produces these really exciting auroral displays.
And then we have, before we take a quick break, we have another question. What is proton aurora? This Katie in Tok writes, "Recently, Jan Curtis, who lives in Wyoming and is a retired meteorologist from UAF, posted a photo on Flickr attempting to explain the difference between ordinary electron aurora and proton aurora. Katie says, I couldn't perceive or see a difference. Could perhaps someone explain what proton aurora is, why it's different from electron aurora, and how we can tell the difference?"
So it's not very easy to tell the difference. So the most of the aurora that we see, the really bright stuff, is produced by electrons being accelerated. But those same processes that happen in the magnetosphere can also accelerate protons down into our upper atmosphere. Now, protons are a lot heavier, and so they can't produce these very, very narrow channels like we see with the aurora, with the electron aurora sometimes. So typically, the proton aurora is much broader. It's rarely as bright as the electron aurora. And the best way to do that is to have a special spectrograph to be able to look and whether you're seeing hydrogen emissions, because the proton basically is just a hydrogen without its electron. And as it's coming down, sometimes they'll latch onto an electron and it'll produce the emissions that you see in a hydrogen atom. So, those of us who've been watching this for a while can sort of look at something and say, yeah, that's probably a proton aurora. What we would see is if you see sort of the sharp edge of the electron aurora in a sensitive camera, there's usually sort of this sort of fuzzy blob a little bit toward the equator in northern hemisphere. That'd be a little bit further south. that's usually where the proton aurora is happening there. It's just not quite as exciting, just because it's never very intense like the electron aurora. But it's actually quite important because it sets up some interesting dynamics and some electrodynamics in the upper atmosphere that are kind of driving what's going on when we see it.
All right. Well, thank you for that. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the science of the aurora borealis as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are discussing the science of the aurora borealis and also the fun and mystique of seeing those colorful lights in the winter night sky. Our guests today are Don Hampton. Don is a research associate professor at UAF and the Geophysical Institute. Vincent Ledvina is a space physics PhD student at UAF and owner of an Aurora tour company in Fairbanks. And Brian Venwa is a reporter based in Kodiak and an award-winning photographer who often gets up late at night and heads out to get shots of those beautiful lights in the sky. You can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255. That's the number statewide. We are having some phone issues, so if you don't get through, maybe try texting or, email, talk@alaskapublic.org. You can probably also text to that address as well. The local number, if it is working, is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. We do have a caller on the line. Let's go to Eric in Fairbanks. Hello.
Hi, can you hear me now?
Yes.
First, a comment, several comments. I've been photographing the Northern Lights for about 50 years, and I live in Fairbanks. Of course, I was shooting black and white film at the time. It was called Tri-X, and you developed it for longer than normal. And you got some white streaky stuff in the sky, and it was interesting, and it was the best you could do then. And I just want to say, I know several enthusiastic aurora photographers, and we share our experience and our philosophy of shooting the Northern Lights. One philosophy is use long time exposures, and this produces brighter colors but soft edges because the aurora is moving. And I prefer short exposures that capture the delicate feathery edges of the aurora. It's the way it actually looks to the human eye, but it's much more difficult to actually get those sharp images, especially when the aurora isn't very bright. I guess that's about it. Video has been my latest challenge because the shutter on the video camera is such a short exposure. It's hard to get any kind of really good, bright aurora images with video. Time lapse is easy, but it's not realistic because it makes the aurora look fast. So I just wanted to share that experience.
I notice, Eric, you had sent in an email earlier, and you said at the bottom of it, shooting the Northern Lights are my greatest joy and hobby in Fairbanks. What is it about that that brings you so much joy, especially after so many decades?
Oh, it is still magical to see the aurora in the sky. I mean, it's colorful. It's science. It's beauty, and it's a challenge to photograph it. And when I and I try to stay up, watch the aurora forecast, watch the all sky camera that the Geophysical Institute is running out at Poker Flat. In fact, I sit on my couch late at night watching the all-sky camera, and if the aurora comes out, I just put my parka on and head outside.
Good for you. That's fantastic. Just, that,
and then if I sleep through an aurora, get up the next morning, and the Geophysical Institute has a recording of the previous night. Oh, it just gripes me to see at 7 in the morning what I missed the night before.
And no reruns. can't wind it back. Thank you.
The aurora 2 days ago was outstanding, and I was out until 2 in the morning.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, Eric. It's wonderful to hear your enthusiasm after 50 years. That's fantastic that you're still enjoying it so much. And as we know, it's free. You can go see these auroras, and it doesn't cost you a dime except for gas if you have to drive somewhere. We have another email question from Paul in Homer. Paul asks, they seem to happen later at night. Is that correct? Are they happening during the day as well? Is there any correlation to time of day? Who wants to take a shot at that?
This is John. I'll take that. Yeah, the late at night is has to do with the geometry. So the region in our magnetic field, the magnetosphere, where these processes happen, happens to be on the other side of the Earth from the sun. And if you map that along magnetic field lines, that happens around midnight. So typically in Fairbanks, the best time to go watch aurora is between kind of 11 and 2 local time. That doesn't mean they're not happening. There's a phenomenon called dayside aurora. And if you go up to an island called Svalbard, there's about a 5 or 6 week period when you can actually watch this dayside aurora. And in the summertime, there's aurora happening. We've got radar systems out at Poker Flat Research Range that can look at the ionosphere. We can't see it because there's so much scattered light from the sun, but we can see the ionosphere changing due to the precipitation of aurora at nighttime as well. But it's just so bright in Fairbanks, we can't see it then. So that's a great question. Yeah, it's happening all the time. There's a region called the auroral zone or the auroral oval. And if you look at a satellite with special wavelengths, you can actually see there's aurora kind of happening in there all the time. It gets very dim sometimes, that oval shrinks up, and sometimes it gets very bright and it expands, and that's when people in Minnesota and Colorado are watching the aurora.
All right, we have a note from Carl, who writes, your guest is partially incorrect about the ability of the eyes to perceive aurora colors at night. It's not the issue that our eyes have cells instead of a sensor. The issue is the cones in our eyes. The cones are part of the eye that perceives color. They do not work well in dark conditions. Light needs to be brighter for the cones to function. That is why we do not perceive color of the aurora with the naked eye until the aurora gets brighter. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I guess I just didn't want to get into the whole discussion of rods and cones, but they're absolutely correct. yeah, so we have rods and cones. Those are the cells. So there's two types of photoreceptor cells in our eyes. There's the rods, which are, you know, light sensitive, but they only give us black and white vision. They work, you know, at all times. And then there's the cone cells, which are color sensitive. We have different kinds of cone cells, which correspond to different colors of light that we see. And, you know, those need some sort of light to activate. So at night, there's not enough light. So your cones kind of shut down. You're just left with your rod vision and you see mostly black and white. If you go outside, it doesn't matter if you're looking up at the night sky or if it's just a dark sort of, you know, situation in, you know, in your house, you'll notice that you really only see black and white. And so a really, really bright aurora will activate more of those cones and you can start seeing the colors. I will also add that a full moon provides enough ambient light where if you look at the moon for a little bit, that'll activate most of your cones. And if you look back at the aurora, you typically see more color. That's also true for street lights and light pollution as well. Sometimes that added ambient light will allow you to see more colors in the aurora, although the aurora is more dim then because, of course, there's other lights kind of washing it out. But I notice that when I'm, because I live in North Pole right now, and we have some annoying security lights on, you know, on our building. But when I walk out to see the aurora and I am kind of looking at those lights in the corner of my eye, I can notice the greens every single time, even if the aurora is fairly dim. So it's just a little interesting nuance there. But yeah, definitely that is correct that we have rods and cones, and the cones are really what give us the color vision.
Vincent, we're going to go back to the phones here in a moment, but you mentioned earlier in a previous interview that you, the life cycle to an aurora, and describe what that is. You likened it to a rubber band.
Yeah, and Don can also talk about this too, but there's sort of this life cycle to the aurora that happens maybe once or twice a night. It's called the substorm cycle. People might have heard of substorms, but you know, over the course of the night, the aurora will kind of grow in the sky. You often see that as these really nice auroral arcs stretching from east to west, gradually moving from the northern sky to the southern sky. That's sort of the substorm growth phase. It's like a rubber band. Earth's magnetic field in space is sort of stretching out, holding all this energy that's being, you know, that's building and building, kind of like a battery charging up. And then all of a sudden, in 1 to 2 minutes, that auroral arc you see in the sky just erupts with what are called auroral beads. And some listeners might have seen, or may have seen these actually, You know, these happen every single time we have a substorm, more or less. They're like these little fingers or little pillars of aurora that form along one of these auroral arcs, and that sort of sets off this huge explosion of aurora, which we call the expansion phase. And in Earth's magnetic field in space, that rubber band basically, it's like it snaps, and like all the energy that was pent up is suddenly released down, you know, streaming along magnetic field lines into the atmosphere. So over the course of the night, you get this growing, and you get this, you know, sudden release of energy in the aurora, which sort of culminates in the best of the show for the night. You know, you have dancing aurora, super, super bright, you know, moving all across the sky, and that aurora races from the southern sky to the northern sky. And then after that, you have this sort of recharge or recovery phase, which can last multiple hours. You sometimes get pulsating aurora, like these patches turning on and off, and then the whole cycle repeats itself.
Mm. So interesting. Thank you. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Roland is in Anchorage. Hello.
Hello. How are you doing?
Good. Did you have a question?
Good. So my question is years ago I worked in Antarctica, and we experienced this phenomenon called, what I was told, called nacreous clouds. And it happened in the early Antarctic spring. And they would show up in the sky, and they didn't act like aurora. They didn't move around. It just looked like someone took really bright oil paint and smeared it in the sky. And they would move really slowly, and they'd be low on the horizon. So my question is what are those? Is that a thing, or am I just seeing like really slow-moving aurora?
That's a real phenomenon, and it is much different than aurora. So that is actually water ice at high altitudes in our atmosphere, but not as high as the aurora. The water ice is basically just refracting the sunlight. So it can be dark on the ground, but those are high enough up that the sun is still shining on them, and you're seeing reflected and refracted sunlight off of those. It's beautiful. It's really nice, but it's not quite the same as the aurora.
Mm, interesting. Thank you so much for the call, Roland. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the lights in the winter sky. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're talking about the science of the aurora borealis, or the northern lights. Don Hampton, research associate professor at UAF and the Geophysical Institute, is on the line with us, as is Vincent Ledvina, a space physics PhD student at UAF and owner of an aurora tour company in Fairbanks. Brian Venwa is on the line from Kodiak. Brian is also an award-winning photographer who spends a lot of time shooting the night sky. You can try to join us by phone. We're having some phone line issues, so if you can't get through by phone, you can email talk@alaskapublic.org. But our phone numbers are 1-800-478-8255 across the state. That's 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422, 550-8422. Brian, for people who don't, you talked a little about this earlier, but for people who don't have professional gear, what tips do you have for them for getting the best shots on either their phone or their consumer camera?
I think the number one thing is definitely to have a tripod. That's kind of the number one thing, is just because your hand, even holding your phone, your phone's automatically, I talked a little bit about long exposures, that one caller talked a little bit about trying to get shorter ones. Your phone's going to automatically go into a long exposure when it enters night mode, which means you might notice that you can't take a bunch of photos in a row, and it's because your sensor's on for a few seconds. What I'd estimate it's about like 3 to 4 seconds. So just even finding anything to stabilize it. A tripod's the best thing. The next best thing is just lean against your car or a tree nearby, or lean your phone on a rock when you push the button. And that'll help stabilize things and help keep, you know, all of the trees or whatever that you else have in your photos a little bit more sharp. And that's something that I think is really undervalued, is just like being steady in some capacity. I'm sure, Vincent, you probably want to have a lot of thoughts about using tripods and different gear and long exposures.
That makes sense, that you would need something stable so that you're not blurring your shot. Brian, I want to stay with you for just a minute. What about editing photos once people have them? And you have thoughts about the difference between photojournalism and digital art. Talk a little about that.
Yeah, so it's pretty common practice for a lot of photographers to plug whatever they capture into Lightroom, or Photoshop is definitely the one that a lot of people know about. And I think it's important to note that photoshopping isn't just adding in other things or taking away different parts of a photo. Photoshopping is also brightening dark areas of a photo. It's also darkening overly bright parts. And there is a line where not all photography is created equal in terms of photojournalism. For photojournalism, you might do like some really, really basic things, really light touching to get rid of a dust spot on your sensor or to boost the shadows just a little bit to improve technical clarity or whatever. But then there's also art photography, and art photography is just as valuable, and a lot of people love it, where it's like, oh, I set the shot specifically. I maybe didn't include some, like a bush nearby that might have put important context or whatever helps that location. And then there's fully what I would consider, this is like, it's a digital art that's based on a photo. Mm-hmm. And at that point, to me, is when you start changing the color of things. I've sold photos where I've changed the color of an Aurora that was a little bit more of a yellow hue to a little bit more of a green one. But that's, I don't market it as a photojournalist thing. I don't market it as a photo. I say that, yeah, it's kind of a digital art piece that I spent time editing that wasn't exactly what was on my camera or was significantly different from what was on my camera. And it's important to have those differences in note when you look at especially professional photographers, they just happen to use these tools. It's, to me, it's no different than using like a paintbrush on a painting or a drill to take out your door hinge.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go back to some email questions here. Dennis asks, has there ever been a greater than K9 solar storm event? Is it possible to have a solar storm that overwhelms Earth's magnetic field and negatively affect living systems? Don, you want to take a shot at that?
Yeah, so the K index that we use, and the KP is the planetary index, it's sort of like the Richter scale. It's each level is essentially an order of magnitude bigger. It does stop at 9. If there's a storm that's bigger than one we've seen before, it would still be a KP9. That's nothing to do with the storm itself. That has to do with how we design the KP system. The Carrington event was probably one that would cause some concern for us, at least technologically. And in terms of affecting life systems on the planet, the good news is the magnetic field does a pretty good job of absorbing a lot of that energy that comes from the sun, and so there might be some localized effects of maybe more radiation on the surface. But I think our atmosphere and the magnetic field are really going to do a good job. It would have to be a really, really big storm to risk taking out a significant portion of the population, something like that. So, no, I think we're reasonably safe there. I can't say 100%, but I think we're pretty good there.
Okay, good. Might make a great science fiction movie, but hopefully not reality. We don't want that. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Linda is in Palmer. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Hello. Thank you for the show.
Yes. What is your comment or question?
Yeah. Oh, I have a story to share. I had lived in Kotzebue from 84 to 89, and then the summer of 87, two friends and I were the first group of people on the Noatak River for 2 weeks. And we used to play this game when we were kayaking, where we tried to guess what time it was by the way we were going around the sun. But one night late paddling, we looked off into the horizon, and we were like, what is in the sky over there? And we determined that it was daylight northern lights. So when I heard the guest earlier talk about daylight northern lights, we didn't see them. It was faint, but we were convinced that that's what it was. It was pretty special. Just wanted to share that story with you.
Thank you, Linda. And that kind of raises the issue of how often it is happening. We know that some nights there might be aurora activity, but it's cloudy. So, Don, how frequent is aurora borealis happening? And is it more seasonal? Is it year-round? What's the science there?
Yeah. So the activity in the solar wind does follow the solar cycle. So at solar max, where we are right now, there tend to be more of these storm events, but also the solar wind itself seems to be a bit more active. At solar minimum, which is going to be 5 or 6 years from now, there can be many nights when you don't really see much in the way of aurora. If you've got sensitive cameras say in Fairbanks or up on the North Slope, and look overhead, you'll see there's a little bit of aurora going on. So there's always aurora happening. It's just the stuff that we want to watch is not always happening as well. So almost any night there's always some aurora happening. As far as visible aurora, at Solar Max, we see it quite a bit more often. I sort of keep track of that as I'm going along with the cameras we run. And pretty much every night this fall so far, we've had aurora. But as you say, it's been cloudy many of the nights, especially here in Fairbanks. In 5 years from now, there will be nights when the sky will look pretty dark and not much is going on. So that's the big modulator of when we see aurora. It is somewhat seasonal. There's a bit more activity in the spring and fall equinoxes. That has to do with sort of the fact that the Earth's magnetic field is tilted slightly from our rotational axis, and how that couples with the solar wind changes a little bit. But that's just a statistical variation. It's not a large variation. And like I said, the best time to watch for the really active aurora is sort of late at night. That's you've got to be a night owl, or you've got to take a nap in the afternoon or whatever, and get up. About 11 to 2 on sort of a given night, especially here in Fairbanks, is the time you might start to see some active aurora.
All right. Sounds like a good activity for retirement. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. We only have a couple minutes left here. Robert is in Esther. Hello.
Hi, Lori.
Hi.
Hey, Don, this is Bob Grove, so I won't give you too bad of a time.
Good to hear you, Bob.
I worked at the geophysical like 100 years ago. And some of the tools that I'm curious as to whether they're still being used. I think they are, the AllSky camera and some of that. I was a part of helping develop, believe it or not. And I had to laugh at whether or not the question about can you see the aurora year-round. And that reminds me of being in Denali and looking at the logbook when one of the favorite questions from tourists is, when can you turn the aurora on? And I always thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah, could you maybe, Don, turn it on a little earlier at night so that I could see it? Maybe like 9:30.
Yeah, exactly.
That's definitely a running joke we have: is who put the requisition in for the aurora?
Whoops.
Go ahead.
Walking over somebody.
Go ahead,
I got
Bob.
Paid to actually watch the aurora out at Poker Flat, and I first worked out there when they first opened it up. So I was actually part of the development of Poker Flat. And also was involved with creating the Alaska Spaceport Corporation. And I'm not sure if that's what it's called. But anyway, one of the things that was amazing to me was the international scientists that would come to Fairbanks just shoot a rocket off into the aurora. And so it was pretty interesting, some of the data that was collected and how it was. Back then people just looked at the magnetometer, and sometimes you couldn't really see the aurora even at night, but you knew it was there because you could see the magnetic storm hitting. And I was just curious, this question's for Don, is whether or not they still use the magnetometer to that extent.
All right. Thanks for the call, Bob and Esther. And Don, we only have about a minute left. What do you have to say to that?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Bob. Yeah, we're definitely still using all those technology, but we've got some new ones. We've got a new radar and some other things as well. And Bob, you bring us a great point. One of the tools we use for doing the auroral studies is the sounding rockets out of Poker Flat Research Range. So if you're in Fairbanks and want to know when that's going to happen, you can go to pfrr.alaska.edu and check that out. There's a way you can get a text message when that's going to happen. We've got three missions coming up in late January or early February, so it should be pretty exciting.
That sounds fantastic. Thanks for that. We'll try and link to that on the Talk of Alaska post as well, where we're also going to put some photos, so you can go to the Talk of Alaska post at alaskapublic.org here after the program and see some of those photos. In our final minute here, for all of you, are there aurora cameras available, like the cameras that people can log in to watch bears?
There's explore.org has one now at the Large Emerald Research Farm here in Fairbanks. As somebody mentioned earlier, we've got one at a Poker Flat that's running every night, both in Poker Flat, also at Petulik Lake in northern Alaska. We're trying to get one down in Gakona. That computer keeps bugging us for some reason. We're having trouble with that. But that's allsky.gi.alaska.edu. You can take a look at that as well. And we try to get that going every night. I certainly know when it's not working because we start getting emails.
Vincent, are most of the people that take your tours coming from out of state, or is it local folks?
Yeah, mostly out of state, and a lot of people from out of the country as well. And I also will add that there are hundreds of Aurora cameras just all over the U.S., all over the world. That's one of the best ways to just track what the activity is doing, is to look at cameras and see what's going on. It's the easiest way to know if the Aurora's out, in my opinion.
And Brian, my last question to you is, do you see yourself maybe expanding and taking people on Aurora tours in the future on Kodiak Island like Vincent does?
You know, it's kind of hard to guess when the Aurora is going to be here in Kodiak, but I'm always happy. If anyone ever wants to and sees a good forecast, I'm always happy to take people out, especially just as my friends, to just find things and explore. And I always advocate that it's always good to go out and touch grass and see real nature than just hiding behind screens all the time anyway.
Absolutely. That's a great note to end on. Thanks to our engineer today was Dave Waldron. Our producer is Madeline Rose. Our editor is Annie Feit. And Ava White helped us out on the phones. I'm Laurie Townsend. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.